Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, lots of good information on how to prevent cardiovascular disease naturally. We're going to help people live a longer life. New information from Dr. Julia Scope. Then, from Dr. Heather Olaf, the power of protecting your prostate using flower pollen. We're also going to look at, can coconut fat that you would get from coconut oil or eating coconuts keep your brains from aging too fast? For those of you who work night shifts or are out very late, how sleep and memory go hand in hand. And how can we clear out congestion? Well, we can use some herbs. I'll share those herb remedies to reduce inflammation. They're easy to do, and a lot more on health and healing. From our environmental segment today, pollution is the leading cause of death in the developing world. From Triple Pundit, could cattle feedlots, that's where the cattle stay for a week or two before they're slaughtered, and there's lots of them, could they be spreading antibiotic resistance through the air? Well, that's something new. Well, the scientists are taking a look at it from Texas Tech University, and they're concerned. I'll share the best of that. Did you know that 100% of all baby killer whales along the West Coast have died? Well, the alarm bell should ring. No newborns have survived in the past 3 years. Quote, this is absolutely the worst thing possible. Pregnant orca dies with decomposing stillborn full-term fetus inside. We're going to lose them. They'll be extinct for sure. From Energy News, not a single word in the media about this. So what could be causing it? That's why you don't have a single word in the media about it. Think Fukushima. And then today's an anniversary. Well, almost, it was 2 months ago, hundreds of thousands of Chileans somberly marched to mark the 40th anniversary of their nation's September 11th terrorist event. Do you remember when that happened? It was when the Chilean military, armed with a generous supply of funds and weapons from the United States and assisted by the CIA and other operatives, overthrew the democratically elected government of the moderate socialist Salvador Allende. 16 years of repression, torture, and death followed under the fascist Augusto Pinochet, while the flow of hefty profits to U.S. multinationals, that's according to Andy Peskett of Global Research. Why is that important? Because why is Henry Kissinger walking around free today? Crimes against humanity. And a special clip I found from 2001 where Christopher Hitchens talks about Henry Kissinger and his crimes against humanity, something that I think is worth hearing again all these years later. And if time permits, a commentary from John Chuckman from Countercurrents, The Elephant in the Room. We'll talk about that. Let's begin. We know so much now about how the heart works and what causes it to go into default when we end up with a stroke, a heart attack, and any one of about 16 different conditions that adversely affect the heart. So in our efforts to prevent this or to understand it, the average American relies almost always upon medications like statin drugs, or risky surgical treatments that can only be effective after the fact. But then again, do they actually cure conditions? Does a coronary bypass operation or a stent actually cure the condition? No, it does not. And those reoccluded arteries and infections cause people to die. So while our pharmacopoeia of drugs is indeed large and powerful, it is not healing people. It is not a part of an integrated solution for this gigantic problem. So what do we do? Well, first we become aware that there's so many good things we can do with lifestyle and behavior modification that become actual therapies, what we call functional lifestyle, meaning the choice I'm making will actually function in a good way to prevent a disease, or if I have a disease, can help improve it, especially cardiovascular disease in both prevention and management. And in particular, an apparent simple combination of nutrients from a berry and a vegetable sprout has shown remarkable clinical effectiveness in lowering dangerous low-density lipoproteins and triglycerides and raising the good HDLs. Also, it reduces inflammation, reverses visible atherosclerotic changes in damaged blood vessels. So that's good. So this unique formulation offers a broad-spectrum nutritional approach to preventing and treating arterial occlusion as we age. So what is it? Well, it's a powerful nutritional strategy. It targets oxidation and inflammation. What I mean is, basic research has provided essential clues, which, coupled with ancient traditional healing wisdom, has resulted in a practical combination of nutrients for cardiovascular prevention. So let's examine them. The amla berry, AMLA, it is terrific. It's also called the Indian gooseberry. And if you go to the health food store, you'll see it little kind of orangish, yellow, shriveled up berries. You bite into one, it's chewy, slightly tart, but it's been known by practitioners of Ayurvedic medicine for more than 3,000 years. I throw a bunch into the blender every time I make a smoothie, or you could throw it into hot oatmeal. It's long been known to be one of those wonderful, what we call miracle molecules. The Indian gooseberry, also known as amla, belongs to a group of herbal preparations that, according to Ayurvedic texts, promote longevity and prevent the effects of aging. And now it's come to science to show, does it work? And the answer is yes. There's a growing body of independent evidence that the humble amla berry offers nearly legendary powers in healing and preventing atherosclerosis and related cardiovascular disease. In fact, it turns out that properly purified extracts of amla act in the precise way to break the cycle of oxidation and inflammation and plaque formation that underlies almost all the atherosclerosis and its dangerous consequences, which cause hundreds of thousands of Americans to die every year. In fact, the amla extract ranks near the top of the list of natural compounds most effective preventing atherosclerosis, triggered oxidation, LDL, and other fats. It reduces oxidant damage and scavenges free radicals. It reduces blood sugar, is great for diabetics. It reduces total cholesterol. It reduces the bad LDL cholesterol. It inhibits the production of advanced glycation end products that I talk about all the time. That's when you eat, let's say, a sandwich or a bagel or toast. That browning is really damaging when you eat meat, and it's brown like chicken. There was a program last night that I wanted to see what they were eating. There was this exotic food show where this guy runs around the world eating a lot of disgusting things and telling everybody how great it is. And they don't seem to care for the fact that they're slaughtering the animals. And yesterday he was eating in Romania, and they had a gourmet restaurant specializing in bulls' penises and testicles and placenta and out of pigs, and eating the raw, straight out of the belly, just killed pigs' livers and saying how delectable it was. And you're thinking, my God, this is the state of this country's evolution? Yeah. And then you see this man eating 6 pounds of food, all of it bad, none of it healthy, called Man vs. Food. It's very popular. But before he goes on this challenge in a different city, he goes to the most popular restaurants in each town he visits. And every one of these have people gorging on humongous servings of food, far beyond supersize. These are gargantuan sizes, far more than the body can digest and assimilate and utilize. And that's what causes oxidative damage. That also causes what we call advanced glycation end products, meaning you're damaging your body with sugar-coated proteins that contribute to endothelial dysfunction and atherosclerosis. But nobody attaches this idea that when you have a heart attack and you're laying on the ground, gee whiz, was it that supersized fried chicken that you had? Yeah. Was it the large hamburger with bacon on it? Yeah, it was that also. And how about that all you could eat at that? Yeah, it was all the above. It all causes oxidant damage. But the amla is able to help entirely prevent a lot of this from happening. It reduces both serum and tissue lipid levels in animals by mechanisms similar to those of the statin drugs. So I would recommend this to anyone who's got a problem with cholesterol. And it prevents inflammatory blood cells from sticking. And when blood cells stick, that's a bad thing because that can end up sticking to the walls of your arteries and veins. And also it leads to the production of atherosclerosis. And also amla containing vitamin C rich traditional Indian fruits. So take a look. It's one thing that can help and it's good. And we want to prevent cardiovascular disease, which is the leading cause medically of in our bodies of death. So lower your cholesterol, lower the LDLs, lower your triglycerides, lower your C-reactive protein, lower your homocysteine. And you can do that when you're exercising every day. You're eating a lot of raw foods. You're juicing. You're staying away from the animal proteins, staying away from gluten proteins. And then just add in this 3,000-year-old berry, and it can do a whole lot of good for you. Now, a nutritional supplement has been out there for a long time, and it could help millions of men affected with benign prostatic hyperplasia. It is called Cernitin, CERN, C-E-R-N-I-10, T-I-N, Cernitin. It's a natural remedy derived from pollen extracts. And it's been found to help manage the troublesome symptoms associated with benign prostatic hyperplasia. For those of you who may not be aware, the prostate is about the size of a walnut. It's a gland, and it's part of the male reproductive system. Now, its major function is to contribute seminal fluid. It's located inside the body cavity. The prostate sits in front of the rectum and just below the bladder. And the prostate gland surrounds the urethra and the canal through which urine exits the body. So the prostate gland enlargement can be caused by prostate cancer, but 80% of the time it's attributable to a benign prostatic hyperplasia. So as men get older, the prostate gland increases in size, making benign prostatic hyperplasia one of the most common age-related conditions in men. So the enlarged gland puts pressure on the urethra, acting like a partial clamp. And that's what causes all these numerous urinary symptoms. And it's a progressive disease, but it does not usually cause problems until late in life. It rarely causes symptoms in men younger than, let's say, 40, but it's very common in people over 50. And it can be substantially reversed. The prostate cell growth can be stimulated by accumulation in the prostate of DHT, which is a dihydrotestosterone. It's an active form of testosterone that can be regulated with certain nutrients, and it can be stimulated by accumulation of estrogen. Do you remember on yesterday's program I talked about how dangerous a high-protein average American diet is? Because every time you have animal protein, every time you're stressed, and when you have body fat, all of those contribute to an excess estrogen dominance in the body. That hurts women for their breast, increasing the risk of breast cancer, ovarian cancer, uterus cancer, and in men, prostate cancer. So what we want to do is we want to lower that. We want to help, and that's where the wonderful flower pollen helps. Now, Sernitin is a microbiologically fermented extract created from the pollen of various plants, including ryegrass. And pollens, meaning the male seeds that enable flowering plants to reproduce, are gathered directly from plants in the field. By the way, bee pollen is not used. This is not bee pollen. And then the flower pollens are then combined in standardized proportions. And the husks that sheath the microscopic pollen grains are removed using a technology to eliminate the bacteria and fungi and toxins and pollutants that are attached to the husk. Which is one of the reasons, by the way, I suggest that every time you use anything from the field, rice, millet, rye, just wash it. Put it in a strainer, fine mesh strainer, and rinse it. Anyhow, this produces a product that is free from toxic substances and less likely to cause allergic reactions. Now, the two fractions are produced in the extraction process, a hydrophilic water-soluble fraction and a lipophilic fat-soluble fraction, and Sernitin contains both the water and fat-soluble fractions, and it's really effective. It's really good, and research validates its effects. There's a number of good trials conducted to evaluate the effectiveness of Sernitin, and it has beneficial effects on the management of benign prostatic hyperplasia. So in one group, there was a 78% reduction in hyperplasia for those that use Sernitin. So, but it has other benefits as well. All you have to do is look at the scientific literature. A quick review shows that it has anti-inflammatory effects. That's good for all parts of the body. It protects against colds, influenza, and infectious mononucleosis. It speeds recovery from the flu and prostatitis and urethritis. It accelerates both wound healing and healing bone fractures in difficult-to-heal situations. It diminishes the side effects of radiotherapy and cobalt treatment in cancer patients. It relieves pain and improves mobility in osteoarthritis. It improves symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis. It relieves unwanted menopausal symptoms. It reduces tiredness in children and elderly, protects against cardiovascular disease, and inhibits certain types of cancer. So that's a whole lot of good from just one single natural nutrient, or a series of nutrients taken from the pollen of grasses. And finally, from our health and nutrition, I'm always asked about coconut oil, and I happen to believe that coconut is one of nature's most perfect foods, and especially the oils. This is from the University of Copenhagen. It says the following, and this was done at the Health Aging Center, University of Copenhagen, and the National Institutes of Health. Quote, mice placed on a high-fat diet appeared to fight off symptoms of aging of the brain. If they were, and also they have better repair of the DNA. In humans, this defect causes the disorder which prematurely aids people. So this is about the coconut oil, and it was the coconut oil that did it. So I imagine that even though there has been a study specifically on Parkinson's, I certainly advocate for the brain. Coconut, it's one of the best single things you can do. Just remember, our brain has a constant need for fuel in the form of either sugar or so-called ketones. Now, ketones are the brain's fuel reserve, and in particular play an important role in periods of low blood sugar levels, for example, if you're fasting. This is because the body breaks down fat if it needs sugar, and during this process it produces ketones. And hence, when you're using the fats from coconut, it is a outstanding fat for the brain and for energy. So the takeaway message is coconut fat can help our brains from aging too fast. one last thing. I mentioned from Brandeis University, why all-nighters don't work, how sleep and memory go hand in hand. If you want to do better tomorrow at work and memory, writing, on a test, you better get a good night's sleep. Scientists have long known that sleep and memory and learning are deeply connected. Almost all animals, from flies to humans, have trouble remembering when sleep-deprived, and studies have shown that sleep is critical in converting short-term into long-term memory, a process that is known as memory consolidation. But just how that process worked has remained a mystery, and so therefore this study from Brandeis University showed how it works. So the takeaway message is this. When you have a good night's sleep, when you're rested, you're going to have a better short-term and long-term memory. You have better cognition. But when you're working overnight, when you're staying up late at night, when you're not getting quality sleep, your memory is going to be affected. Your immune system will be affected. Your health will be affected. And you'll, if it's chronic, you'll live about 8 years shorter lifespan. So, something to think about. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. How sweet it is to be loved by you. Yes, baby. Ooh. How sweet it is to be loved by you. Ooh, baby. I needed the shelter of someone's arms. And there you. Nice to have you on board, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. There's an important article published in Global Research by Andy Pasek, and it deals with Henry Kissinger and why he has not been challenged as a war criminal or crimes against humanity. Let me quote him. Quote, 2 months ago, hundreds of thousands of Chileans somberly marked the 40th anniversary of their nation's September 11th terrorist event. It was on that date in 1973 that the Chilean military, armed with a generous supply of funds and weapons from the United States, and assisted by the CIA and other operatives, overthrew the democratically elected government of the moderate socialist president. 16 years of repression and torture and death followed under the fascist Augusto Pinochet, while the flow of hefty profits to multinationals, IT&T, Anaconda, Copper, and the like, resumed. Profits, along with concern that people in other nations might get ideas about independence, were the very reason for the coup and even the partial move towards nationalization instituted by the former president. And that just couldn't be tolerated by a U.S. business class. Henry Kissinger was national security advisor and one of the principal architects, perhaps the principal architect, of the coup in Chile. U.S. instigated coups were nothing new in 1973, certainly not in Latin America, and Kissinger and his boss, Richard Nixon, were carrying on a violent tradition that spanned the breadth of the 20th century and continues today. For example, in Venezuela in 2002 that failed, in Honduras in 2009 that was successful, and now in the Ukraine, where possible, such as the Guatemala 1954 and the Brazilian one in 1964. Coups were the preferred method for dealing with popular insurgencies. In other instances, direct invasion by the United States forces, such as happened on numerous occasions in Nicaragua, the Dominican Republic, and many other places, was the fallback option. So here now, from 2001, is Christopher Hitchens discussing Henry Kissinger and why he should be charged with crimes against humanity.
Henry Kissinger is considered by many to be America's most brilliant modern statesman. The former National Security Advisor and Secretary of State has his fair share of critics too, but none quite like journalist Christopher Hitchens. He claims that Kissinger should be viewed as a war criminal. And he makes his case against him in his new book called The Trial of Henry Kissinger. You've written an absolutely scathing indictment of Henry Kissinger and his alleged involvement in illegal foreign policy operations in Vietnam, Chile, and elsewhere. And you've gone as far as to say that he should be put on trial as a war criminal. I mean, given his icon status as a brilliant statesman, I mean, this seems outrageous. I mean, what's your purpose here? What are you trying to do in this book?
I'm trying to narrow a gap that, when you look at it, is a very conspicuous one indeed in the American public discourse. And it's this, it's simple to identify. The United States, as well as being the founding and senior and host country of the United Nations and of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which enshrines the Nuremberg Principles and other things, is also the main moral tutor and lecturer to the rest of the world on the need to punish war criminals, bring them to speedy justice, observe canons of human rights, on pain, I might say, of punishment, up to and including sanctions or even bombing. That, no one will dispute, that is the case.
Mm-hmm.
It meanwhile argues in private that these canons of law, now enshrined in a whole new tribunal to which the US is signatory at The Hague, to make these principles even more permanent and active and operational, do not and should not apply to Americans. The conspicuous instance of the discrepancy or of the contradiction would be the esteem granted to a man like Henry Kissinger, who, if there really was equality before the law internationally, would be wanted already in a number of countries for gross offenses against human rights.
Let's look at your case against Kissinger, beginning with the Vietnam War and your allegation that when the North and South Vietnamese were negotiating a possible peace, that Kissinger intervened and convinced the South Vietnamese that they would be better off under a Republican regime, and in doing so, prolong the war. And I think
Yes. You
go as far as to say that this could be the single wickedest act in the history of the Republic. How so?
I think we can now state with certainty, not as a speculation, not as a conjecture or hypothesis, or let alone a conspiracy theory, that there are enough memoirs and depositions from living or actual participants in the events to say that in the fall of 1968, an election year, candidate Richard Nixon and three of his senior associates evolved a plan to win the election by sabotaging the official U.S. government negotiating position in Paris with the Vietnamese, as you've said. And they did this by the simple method of opening an illegal back channel. I say illegal because it violated the Logan Act, which prohibits private diplomacy by American politicians, to the South Vietnamese military junta, and told them that, in effect, if they were to collapse the peace negotiations by withdrawing and timing their withdrawal for the eve of the elections, thus kicking away the main plank of the Johnson-Humphrey years and the re-election plank of Mr. Humphrey himself, Vice President Humphrey, which was the peace plank. And if that was to lead to the Republican Party winning the election, which was very, very tight, people forget how tight it was,
mm-hmm.
That they could be, they being the South Vietnamese military leadership, could be assured of a more friendly government in Washington. And the three people with whom Mr. Nixon evolved and carried out this design were Vice President Agnew, future Vice President Agnew, candidate Agnew then, Governor Agnew, future Attorney General John Mitchell, and Henry Kissinger.
The counterclaim.
So a mortgage was taken out, an illegal mortgage, a lease, if you will, on another 4 years of war, and that mortgage had to be paid, but it was paid for in the lives of half of the United States casualties in the war. 22,500 of the names on the Vietnam Wall are the names of men who fell after that deal was cut. So that's why I say the scope of that crime, which involves the subversion and tainting of an American presidential election,
mm-hmm.
and the extension of a war for 4 years, and its extension into two neutral countries, which can be described as one single action, would count as the wickedest thing I know of in American history.
There's been a counterclaim that the entire negotiations in Paris were just part of the 68 presidential campaign anyway, and that the bomb pausing had been part of the Humphrey Democratic strategy to get political advantage, and that this was just kind of fair politicking in another front.
That's a claim made by Henry Kissinger and repeated because I reprint it in my book. It's an attack he made on me in the New York Times. And it's a very suggestive one, I submit, because instead of saying what I, imply or assert is outrageous and unconscionable. Instead, he says, well, everyone was playing politics with the war at that time. In other words, he doesn't deny that there was such a plan or could have been. That's interesting in itself. Second, he says, well, yes, even Mr. Humphrey was hoping to get re-elected by these peace negotiations. Well, one might as well just point out, Mr. Humphrey was the elected and duly constituted Vice President of the United States. Right? He and his president had won the election, rather convincingly, actually, in point of fact, by the largest majority ever recorded in an American election.
And therefore had a legitimacy.
They were the entitled and appointed negotiators.
Furthermore, those negotiations.
For the Logan Act is the Logan Act for precisely the reason that while such things are going on, no other party in the state can try and make a secret diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. You also claim in the book that probably the single strongest legal case against Kissinger relates to declassified CIA documents that you have revealed and reprinted in the book that seem to indicate that he was directly involved in an assassination of a Chilean general who was against the ouster of President Allende at the time. Tell me about that story.
I think it's the strongest single case upon which Kissinger could be indicted, and it is the reason for the great nervousness that he shows about the new revelations of documents and the new legal context in which these occur. Briefly to state it, General René Schneider, the head of the Chilean General Staff in 1970, was a conservative-minded constitutionalist officer, a gentleman, honorable guy, who wanted to uphold the great tradition whereby the Chilean armed forces did not intervene in the election process. They didn't pick the next president of Chile. President Nixon evolved another plan, which was that it would suit them better if the military did intervene to pick the president of Chile. Well, the main obstacle to that was the head of a general staff who said, no, that's not my job. My job is to safeguard the transition. So the next stage was to say, well, then this man must go. He must be taken off the chessboard. And we now have all the documents, and I've reprinted them all, that say there was a meeting at which it was decided Schneider must go. Identifiable men of violence in Santiago, people who had before tried to overthrow a conservative government in Chile from the right, a Christian democratic regime. In other words, not to mince words, a fascist group with a proven record of violence, was found. Illegal money was sent to it. We have the records of that. Illegal weapons were shipped through the U.S. diplomatic bag for their convenience and for their reassurance, because they had guns of their own, but they needed the assurance of American endorsement. They were encouraged to repeated attempts on the life of General Schneider, which succeeded at the third attempt, after which they were paid off, which establishes conclusively the chain of complicity. And then the evidence of it was concealed from investigators in Chile and in Washington. It's what we call a lay-down case. And you call it an assassination, and I don't dissent from that, but I would prefer a more old-fashioned word. It's a murder. It's a hit. It's a wet job. It's a whacking out. It's reading what I've presented in the book is like listening to the John Gotti tapes.
But again, the defenders say, well, you know, this was American foreign policy at the time, and that he was simply carrying out what was the deemed law of the land or practice of foreign policy at the time. What's your response to that line of defense?
It's been found beyond doubt by minute investigation in Washington that nobody in Congress, which has the power of the purse in these matters and the power to decide, ever knew that the National Security Advisor of President Nixon, Henry Kissinger, had evolved a plan to murder the head of the General Staff in a democratic country, not contiguous to but neighboring the United States, a democracy with which the United States was not at war. No one was ever told of that plan. We know of no authorization for Kissinger to have carried it out.
Let alone the bombing of Cambodia.
The bombing of Cambodia was likewise concealed from Congress. It's flattering to the American people they have to be lied to so much, I sometimes think. And within the administration, since you argue for an indictment of the administration in general, which might be fair, it should be said that the Secretaries of Defense and State, respectively, Melvin Laird and William Rogers, were both very much opposed to the invasion of Cambodia as a violation of neutrality and of international law, and also as of a misreading of what the real causes of the war in Vietnam were, the idea that if only we could clean up a sanctuary or two across the border, the rebellion in South Vietnam would dry up, seemed to them a fantasy. But there was a group of later indicted criminals around Mr. Nixon who felt that this was the only way their boss's reputation could be saved, and by taking their side against the Secretaries of State and Defense, Henry Kissinger tipped the balance.
What about the old argument of moral equivalency, that these are just part and parcel of practices of the Cold War, and that what the communists were doing was every bit as awful and required a counterbalance?
Attacking and killing a democratic, conservative, constitutional officer in a neighboring democracy with which the U.S. is not at war, and a country, by the way, that can threaten nobody, Chile, in collusion with a fascist criminal group, is not anti-communism. It is, in fact, collusion with fascism. But I'd go further and say that I don't greatly care to be lectured on anti-Stalinism by Mao Tse-tung's best friend, by Leonid Brezhnev's preferred negotiating partner, mm-hmm. By the man who told Gerald Ford when he was president that he shouldn't receive Alexander Solzhenitsyn in the Oval Office, which Congress thought he should, because it might offend the communists, who were Kissinger's friends, by the man who is paid by the Stalinists in Beijing to this day to defend the massacre of their own young people in Tiananmen Square. I won't have it from him that he's doing this against communism. It's just another of the constituents of the gigantic lie that constitutes his reputation. He's a thug and a crook and a liar and a pseudo-intellectual and a murderer, okay? All of those things are factually verifiable. Strong. Factually verifiable.
He's also,
that he is an anti-communist is a speculation that he likes to encourage.
He also was a non-elected, appointed official. I mean, under our system, the British system, the notion of ministerial responsibility, that at the end of the day, the buck stops on the desk of the elected official. If there is a case against Henry Kissinger, is there an equal case against Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford?
Certainly against Richard Nixon. In fact, when the first articles of impeachment were promulgated against Nixon in the Congress, at least one of the first articles, if not the first, instanced his waging of an illegal and secret war in Cambodia without congressional or any other kind of authorization. And it was only after a tremendous backstairs struggle and a lot of horse trading that that article of the impeachment indictment was dropped. And I think it's a great pity that it was. Of course, in the end, it might have been arranged that Mr. Nixon left office without facing a trial and without what some people now like to call closure or clarification. But had that trial occurred in the Congress, we would be living in a very different world, and the United States would be much nearer to being a democracy than it is now.
And then many of these things would be...
But undoubtedly, had that been pursued, Kissinger would not have stood alone in the dock, but he would have certainly had to stand there.
You're saying more than Kissinger is a hardball practitioner of real politics. You're saying that he is, in fact, a war criminal who should be prosecuted. How would that happen, and under what kind of pretext?
Can I just say a bit first about the hardball and the realpolitik?
Sure.
Because I think even people who think of him as repellent think, well, it's a dangerous world out there, you need tough guys, and so on. I don't dissent. I wouldn't mind being a tough guy myself sometimes. There are some people I think need to be dealt with harshly. If you like, one day I'll tell you who I think they are. But look at it. Most of Henry Kissinger's policies actually issue in calamity, farce, fiasco, disaster. Indochina, probably the most perfect failure in the history of American foreign policy. Everybody loses. Everyone's worse off than when they began. Chile. They asphyxiate democracy in Chile for 20 years. It finally revives very painfully. What have they gained? Nothing. Who's lost? Anyone who cares about democracy. East Timor, bloody nightmare. No one the winner. Finally, the Indonesians give up their claim to East Timor and return to a semblance of democracy. Cyprus. Very nearly a war within NATO, a completely pointless and destructive war, leads to the absolute devastation of Cypriot society. Henry Kissinger looks at what he's done, gets on a plane, flies away, never lets the word Cyprus cross his lips ever again. Bangladesh. It goes on and on. Where's the realpolitik in this? This is not a detached, tough-minded conservative statesman conducting business without sentimentality. This is a vandal, a barbarian, a crook. A man who thinks only in the short term and is mainly preoccupied with the reputation of himself and his extremely crooked boss. So it doesn't deserve the name of realpolitik, in my opinion. And nor does it really deserve the name of hardball. Hardball would be understating it. It's thuggery and murder and bloodshed on a vast scale. Criminal, most of it. Breaking either American or international law. This is serious stuff. That was my throat-clearing answer to your question, the rest of which I've now forgotten.
What would be the venue or process by which Kissinger would actually be prosecuted.
Oh, well, now you ask me to summarize, yes, which laws have been broken. Well, some of them are old-fashioned ones, as with Schneider. You don't need a new law to find that murder is still, you know, judges, policemen, juries, they still take it seriously. They get irritated with murder plots, let alone with the execution of the murder plots. You don't need a new law to say that it's wrong to conduct covert action diplomacy during American elections if you are not elected by anyone or appointed to conduct them. You don't need to rewrite the Foreign Assistance Act to know that, as Kissinger knew, he was breaking it when he guaranteed the Indonesians under the counter that they would continue to get arms supplies for the prosecution of their genocidal war in East Timor. He knew he was breaking international law. Excuse me. He knew they were breaking international law. He knew he was breaking American law, helping them to break international law. The Nuremberg principles are vague for historical reasons on whether aerial bombardment of civilians is a war crime or not. That's because the Allies used it so much themselves. Mm-hmm. But there are customary laws and laws of war and elements in the Geneva Convention that could very well support a prosecution. And General Telford Taylor, who was the chief American prosecutor at Nuremberg, believed that the United States had crossed that line before the invasion of Cambodia and before the carpet bombing of it, of which he was unaware when he wrote his book, Nuremberg and Vietnam.
Right.
Then there's the Genocide Convention, which requires of any government becoming aware of an attempt to extirpate any people that they take action there and then, not to punish it, but to prevent it. And that I think, would be very grave in the case of the foreknowledge of Henry Kissinger of the plan by the Pakistani military dictatorship to exterminate the people of Bengal, of what's now called Bangladesh. And would also apply, by the way, very strongly to East Timor, where it's easy to demonstrate foreknowledge and collusion and complicity as well.
But how realistic is all of this? I mean, what has seemed to happen is that war crimes prosecution is something that happens to losers, not winners. And for good or ill, Henry Kissinger was seen as some of the guy who won the Cold War.
Well, if that's to be the finding, then I'll have to live with it, but I won't have to agree with it. And as I began by saying, if that is the way the United States wants to face the world and say, well, it doesn't count if we do it or if one of ours does it, then let them face the world and say that. That's all right by me. That, if that's the outcome of my plea or my polemic, all right. But I think it would prove my case, in a sense, just as strongly as if they decided to become seized of the matter and to clean house themselves. Mm-hmm. If they don't, however, do that, if they go on living with the contradiction, there are people who will not. And now that we know everything we need to know, say, about the murder of General Schneider and the other extension of death squad activities from Washington into Chile, the way is open, and I believe will be taken, for the relatives of those victims to bring a civil suit in the United States, in a federal court, for redress against Henry Kissinger and others. And I think that will happen, and that'll be intensely embarrassing if it's left to volunteers and victims to invoke the law, while the state and the Congress and the courts remain indifferent to it.
Now, this is not the first time you've made these allegations, calling Kissinger a thug and a murderer.
I mean,
you've done this publicly many times, and it's obviously in print, published in the books. Yet Kissinger and his defenders have been strangely silent. Mm. There's been virtually no rebuttal at all. I mean, what do you make of that?
I don't want to charge it to the account of my own success in presenting an unanswerable case, but I haven't found anyone in the American press, not just a Kissinger defender, but someone who hostile, say, to my interpretation, who's been able to rebut it yet. And I have been issuing challenges for that, and I'm still awaiting an answer. I believe myself that it's because of neither of these things. It's because of the awareness on the part of Kissinger that he is legally vulnerable increasingly, and therefore the least said by him the better.
With the election of George W. Bush, I mean, is there any prospect that the influence of Kissinger in American foreign policy would be restored?
There's no evidence that his opinion is being sought. It quite clearly wasn't sought in the recent standoff on Hainan Island, for instance,
right,
with Chinese. And this could be attributable to either to the reservations some Republicans have about him. The Reagan administration, for example, never went near him. They thought he was far too unsound. Or it could be to do with the fact that he isn't very well and hasn't been making much sense lately either. It could be to do with his conflicts of interest, though that isn't a big thing in Republican circles these days, because everyone has to divest themselves of such huge fortunes to get into office. But it would therefore be the perfect context in which this legal decision had to be taken, because it could not be asserted then that there was any element of partisanship to it. In other words, if the law is allowed to take its course, and if the American signature is going to remain, as I believe it will, on the Hague Convention for War Crimes Tribunals to govern matters from now on, even though there's a big reservation about that within the administration, then we would have the ideal laboratory in which to conduct an experiment on America's pragmatism vis-a-vis human rights.
Now, from there, we go to Dr. John Vera Penn, a former Eli Lilly executive who, after 35 years of service, decided to quit and speak out about Big Pharma's methods for profit and the benefit of symptomatic diseases that people live with for the duration of their lives.
I have spent 35 years of my life working in an industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and they do nothing but annihilate the population of this world. And why do they do that? Because they want to make money, 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 money. They don't care about your lives. They only care about their wallets. My hands are just as dirty as these people. The pharma industry gave me a good job. And I felt that I was in medicine because that's what I studied. So I started as a salesman. And as I moved up in my career, where I eventually became a director for a company in Sweden, the affiliate company of one of the largest and most evil pharma corporations in the world, Eli Lilly and Company, because I was part of the evil. I had a career. I did a lot of bad things. They fired me. I started my own company, worked for several other pharma companies, big ones, world players. People are dying from taking medication that was legalized because I had bribed the Swedish government to get the Sulasung for Prozac in Sweden. Now, can you imagine that? Sweden is reputedly one of the cleanest, most transparent countries in the world. They have the Nobel Prize of Medicine. The Americans, they love the prestige of the Nobel Prize. That is why it was important for them to get the registration of Prozac. What is the pharma industry doing to us? They're the most powerful industry in the world. They sleep in the same bed with governments. They use corruption to get what they want. Corruption involves money. They have lots and lots and lots of money, and that is how they make their money. They also kill more people than the wars we have in the world. We need the pharma industry because there are some good things out there, but most of it is rubbish. They're not interested in curing any disease you may have. They're more interested in making you get diseases. They're interested in symptomatic treatment. They want patients who are diabetics, cardiology patients, Parkinson's disease, rheumatoid arthritis, arthrosis, because you live a long time and the drugs that you have to take, you take that for the rest of your life. The press works also with the pharma industry, just like the government does. The pharma companies use the media to implant this dirty work on you. Don't take for granted what your doctor is telling you, because the doctors these days, they don't know much about medicine, and they don't care much about their patients. They think about how much they can get paid. And this is how the pharma industry reigns, stays in power. They buy the doctors. They pick them up when they're in medical school, pay their tuition.
Die Konzerne.
Train them. Because the doctors don't get information from anywhere else except the pharma industry. And I know, because when I was a salesman, the pharma company used to tell me, never talk side effects. They taught us something called FAB. F-A-B. Features, advantages, and benefits. I also know that they hide the dangerous side effects, because I was in charge of a clinical study for Fluctine or Prozac. When the doctors came rushing into my office one day, because we were running a small trial in one of the largest hospitals in Stockholm. Yes. The first week they started the trial, two of the patients tried to commit suicide. And this is a major side effect of these psychotropic drugs. We call them the SSRIs, serotonin, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. The pharma industry, by law, is not obliged to give out information like that. Have you guys heard of ADHS or ADHD? But all these years I've been in medicine, nobody can come and tell me up till now what ADHD is. Syndrome makes it a sickness. Since they can't prove that this is a sickness, they change the S to D, calling it disorder. And when it comes to that kind of disorder, for example, how do they measure serotonin in the brain of a child? Do you know how to do it, doctor? With a Ouija board. That's one way. You get the psychiatrists to sit down, you know, with their little bow ties. Psychiatrists, these are mad people. They sit every year, and they sit in a room, and they make up what they called the Bible for psychiatry, the DSM. If this Bible was so good and so needed and does an exact job, why did they change the rules in this Bible during the last few years so many thousands of times?
I want to thank you all for listening today, and I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day, everyone.